Hello, hi, and welcome. I am your host, Emma Gunnar Wardner, and in my nearly 20-year career as a beauty and health writer, I have interviewed a lot of people. Supermodels, entrepreneurs, authors, celebrities, and doctors. And many of these conversations had a real impact on me, and I'd come away feeling inspired, excited, informed, and really empowered. And at the back of my mind, I'd always think, I wish I could just publish the tape so people could really feel that conversation. Well, on this podcast, you get to feel the conversation. I talk with experts, guests, and a few friends who I hope will inspire, inform, and empower you, and maybe also challenge you, whether you're looking for self-help, self-improvement, beauty advice, health insights, business know-how, or just some good old-fashioned life advice and a bit of a laugh. It's all here. Welcome to the show. What can we learn from a conversation with a brain surgeon? Well, we're about to find out, but the clue is a lot. That's the short answer. When Dr. Rahul Jandial, who is a dual-trained neurosurgeon and scientist, agreed to come on the podcast, I realised there was so much I wanted to ask him. And during his recent whistle-stop tour of London, I was able to sit down with him and get his perspective. And let's face it, this is a perspective that's so unique. He's someone who works with and in the human brain. And I've never been able to have a conversation with someone with that kind of experience or perspective before. And I really wanted to find out and understand if there is a better way to live. What are the life lessons we can learn from a brain surgeon? In this episode, we discussed how to boost memory, how to improve sleep, understand depression and anxiety, and how to train your brain. It's quite a fantastic thing, the brain. And honestly, the way that he describes it, the way that it works, the way that it functions is so mesmerizing. I also ask how much damage I may or may not have done to my own brain at rock concerts in my youth and find out why, I'm talking about headbanging there, of course, and find out why our breath is so important for our brain and our bodies. All the links to Dr. Rahul Jandial will be in the show notes, but for now, here he is, making his debut on The Emma Gunn Show. Dr. Rahul Jandial, thank you so much for being on The Emma Gunn Show.
Pleasure's mine.
This is my first time speaking to a brain surgeon.
Well, I hope to live up to your expectations.
Live up to and exceed them all. goodness me, what you do for a living is quite extraordinary. And we are going to cover a lot of turf in this conversation. But okay. I wondered if you wouldn't mind, and it might seem like an odd place to start, but you describe it so beautifully. I wondered if you could talk about what the brain actually looks like. Because in your book, there's a lot of myth busting about misconceptions we have about the brain. And one of them is what it looks like. And the way that you describe it makes it sound actually quite magical.
It is. It's beautiful. It's the most beautiful thing I've seen inside the human body. And the way I came to see it was accidental. I was destined or driven to be a heart surgeon once I went to medical school. I didn't always want to go to medical school, but once I got there, I knew I wasn't just going to write prescriptions. Mm-hmm. I knew I had to do something with my hands where there was ownership. You meet the patient is under anesthesia, patient comes out. If they're doing well, that's ownership. I loved it. It was mm-hmm. like sculpting. That's the way I think of surgery. Mm-hmm. We use similar tools. And then the brain surgeons where I was training fired the one trainee they hired. It's a very elite group. And they said, do you want to join? And I said, well, I hadn't even seen a single brain surgery in my medical school. And that morning they made an incision from sideburn to sideburn over the top of the head. And the forehead skin and flap was reflected forward. And they made a few holes in the skull and lifted off the skull. And just then I knew I was in a sacred space. And even then, you don't get to the brain. The brain is covered with this sheath. Mm. It's called dura mater. It looks like parachute material. It's thin. It can be picked up. It can be stitched with a fine thread. So they picked it up with little tweezers and stabbed just the sheath. So they picked it up so the brain was separate from the brain underneath. And they sort of unzipped it. And under the bright lights of the operating room, it was nothing like what I had thought it to be. It wasn't gray. It's not gray. It's opalescent. It's iridescent. And the little valleys and the ridges have these fine blue and red mesh of arteries. It looks like a Jackson Pollock painting. And I just thought to myself, this is like no other flesh inside us. Despite it getting 20% of the blood flow from your heart, four major arteries pump straight up into your neck, two in the front next to the jugular vein that we're familiar with, but two also in the back by your spine. That much flow to something that weighs 3 pounds yet the flesh is white. An enigma. We still don't know why. But you could tell at that moment that this was an opportunity for me to study the most magical marvel that one can work with. And it is a physical manipulation of the brain, how to swim around the valleys and creases, how to disrupt it as little as possible, remove the tumor and slither out without it feeling you. That is brain surgery. It's not just opening the skull. And that sort of hit upon something in my life, that the material is something amazing. The stories were even more interesting. The way the patients were hurt, the way the patients recovered, the different ways in the same areas would do different things. It wasn't a pump. It wasn't a joint. It wasn't tubing. It was no longer auto body or auto work, or car work, as they say in the States. And that was interesting to me, because then I said, okay, look, I get to work with my hands in the greatest material. And then I get to understand myself through my patients. So 5,000 skulls I have opened, and 25,000 people about I have shook hands with in clinics. And I'm 47 years old. I'm not a saint. I'm not a healer. I'm not in it just to help people. I am selfish in the way that my patients help me. I always tell them, this is a mutual thing. I am benefiting from helping you. I am learning about myself. I'm learning about humanity. And I'm also shaping a sense of self and identity for myself. So we are partners and allies in this. And I will be with you through unexpected challenges that can happen. So that's the way I look at it. It's not this linear thing like, oh, I wanted to be a medic my whole life. No, I dropped out of college. I was a security guard. I don't like studying. I didn't like studying at that time. But the patient stories, the people stories, the ability to work in a building that has babies to adults, to CEOs, to drug addicts, to crisis, to jail wards, all in one building. That is my office. That is my my workspace, if you will. And then I get to work in a more magical space inside the skull. So that is the, it's not a romantic view of my career and the human brain. It's really what it is.
It's, well, like I said, it is extraordinary. And as you said, it has given you an understanding of humans, of us all, and of yourself. And on this podcast, I have talked many times about habits, and I thought that would be a really nice place to start, because being, I guess, physically close to the brain in the way that you are, I mean, we will get on to how it looks different depending on what's going on. But in terms of habits, does the brain love routine?
It has to, and there's a there's an explanation for it. So I don't have all the answers, and I don't diminish other people that try to explain the brain, the mind, behavior. I just have my perspective. And my perspective is also always, explain it to me a little bit, because then I can believe that you are in the space and have some understanding. So it has to have habits, because as we just discussed, 20% of your blood flow goes to this organ. If it was fully on in all corridors, in all pathways, all the time, the need for food and nutrition would be so high, we wouldn't have survived. So it is efficient. We use 100% of our brain, but to do certain things, we use smaller percentages of it.
Oh, so that's another myth about we only use 20% of our brain.
I might only use 20% of my brain figuring out how to get on the tube and get to the next few stops. But I only use 2% of my brain to tie my shoelaces, because it's become a habit and a behavior. But if I had to always think about how to tie my shoelaces, if I had to always think about how to get home, it would be too much of an energy expenditure. So the brain, because it is such an energy hog, has to become efficient. Otherwise, we would have never survived with limited resources and food scarcity, as was the case for our ancestors. So a habit is really a rut. The habit is really that forged path down a mountain slope for a skier. You tend to just run down that slope. It's easier, it's built, it's comfortable, it uses the least energy. And so habits, they are to your advantage most of the time. But sometimes we find ourselves in a habit that we want to break, or that we have come to look inward and say, this isn't a habit I want to have. Mm. And it requires effort to no longer go down that rut. Mm-hmm. You actually will have to spend more brain energy, use more blood squirting from your heart to do something that is not a habit. Mm-hmm. Therefore, habits are hard to break.
Right.
And so that's the duality in which I hope everybody looks at themselves, is there is no habits are bad or habits are good. There's no emotional self, smart self. We are a blend of all of those things. Your emotions and thoughts are your allies. Sometimes you need to think. If you're being chased in an alley, you don't need to think. That is a resource to you as well. Mm. If the thermostat of being chased in an alley and those emotional responses are there when you're just late because you miss the exit on a freeway, that's too much. Mm. So your thoughts have to dial that down. Similarly, habits are an adaptation, yet we can steer and rein them in or redirect them and create new ones. And that is the challenge, is one, the introspective nature of our lives, to look at our interior lives and say, that habit I don't want anymore. So then it takes time and effort. There is no quick thing. There is no one step, no one blueberry that's going to pop you out of the habit. But the fact that habits can be broken is real. Mm. And everybody has what we call an activation energy. The hill to break the habit, depending on how deeply the habit is formed, depending on where you are in life, that's all individual. But I just want people to know habits are an efficient way for the brain to get things done. But sometimes the most efficient way is not necessarily your best self.
So to that end, is anything possible? You don't need to be defined by who you are today, because you could be different tomorrow with that effort, mm-hmm. as you say.
Yeah.
If you feel like you're being weighed down by a bad habit or something right. that's maybe holding you back.
Is anything possible? Let me answer that in a philosophical sense, based on biology. Mm-hmm. And then get to... It's a matter of degree, and it's a matter of who you are in your own, again, interior life. The same answer cannot apply to 8 billion people. The same answer actually cannot apply to me from a year ago, or me when I was 15, or me when I'm hopefully going to be 55. We are different from our former selves. Mm. So I worry about packaging advice that is supposed to be universal. Mm-hmm. That said, is anything possible? So the liver has the cells that make up the liver are all like tiles. They're uniform. It's just tile work. The heart also has these cells, and the bone cells. They all look like structural components just neatly fit together, Lego blocks. Mm. Your brain is closer to 90-ish billion microscopic jellyfish, throbbing, floating. And then they're so tightly packed, but if you turn the microscope up and zoom in deeper, there are thousands of tentacles of these 90 billion cells. As they come next to each other, they don't touch. They spray chemicals like dopamine and serotonin. So think about, and it's all floating inside fluid inside your skull. Mm-hmm. That fluid you can only get to once you cut that sheath that I talked about. So is anything, look at that system. Mm-hmm. How can you limit that? Mm. Right, that is infinite. Think about the degree of, and those chemicals are spraying at each other. And if somebody takes Prozac or a selective serotonin reuptake inhibitor, that's working at the chemical level. It's keeping more of that serotonin there in those almost kisses of all these tentacles. So the degree of complexity and plasticity is near infinite. Mm. That said, it has certain elements and patterns that we should know about if we want to harness that complexity. And those are quite simply, there's a structure, there's flesh to the brain. They are the building blocks of the brain called neurons or brain cells. And then there's the electrochemistry. Mm. Enough electricity, like electric eels have electricity. Well, each of these jellyfish spark electricity. And when they get to that junction, they spray chemicals, and the other side, there's electricity. So when we think about possibilities, when you read a blog, when somebody says, this is good for your brain, ask them to tell you in which dimension. Will it improve the thinking? It will improve the flesh, the neurons? Where is it working? Is it working at the chemical level or electrical level? And so when you talk about is anything possible, each of those dimensions, different things are possible. And so when you talk about improving your life, I would encourage everybody to look at, okay, where does that change need to happen? Okay, so for example, why is exercise good for the brain? Well, that flesh needs to be irrigated. So now we're in plumbing and flesh and that anatom. So then you have an answer in your mind that says, oh wait, the same activities that keep my heart arteries open also keep my brain arteries open. That way all this flesh, all these jellyfish are supplied with nutrients and oxygen. So in that way, exercise actually preserves your flesh. And so when we get less young, keeping those arteries open will prevent small swaths of those of the brain from dying. Mm. They call those mini strokes. And a lot of old people have those. So that's an explanation. Mm-hmm. And then when I do that with my patients, then I can see in their eyes like, yeah, I should probably walk a little bit more. Now I get what this is about rather than do this, do that. It can't be so prescriptive. And so there are explanations underneath all of these. So anything is possible because when you look at that electrochemical potential, you see that the brain looks the same for Captain Sully and who performed under pressure or Einstein or Paul McCartney. So then how is the outcome of their lives different? Mm. Then we get down to the electrochemical because the flesh looks the same. So that's the way I want people to understand is when somebody says, so we're not manipulated because it's so complex that, and everybody with a brain is now a brain expert, that there are a lot of things out there that just aren't true. Mm. And the way to understand that is to have somebody explain it to you. Well, how is it good for my brain? Mm. So every article actually should have an explanation. If they say it's good for your brain.
Okay. Now, this is slightly left field, but as you're doing that description, I feel very, very guilty about something. All the headbanging I did in the 90s.
Yeah. Rock and roll, soccer, football.
Guns N' Roses.
Guns N' Roses. Nirvana, wow. Yeah. That changed the whole genre. I love... I mean, if you listen to his lyrics, and of course... I'll take it further left field. There are a lot of artists that have committed suicide in their 20s, and they call it a 27 club. Mm-hmm. And a recent rapper, I think Juice WRLD, wrote about it, and he died at 21, but he mentioned the 27 club in his song. So there's this, I don't know, it's not good or bad, it's just something. And now, where are you going with this? Are you going to tell us a story about the anatomy? No. Because their brains look the same. Mm-hmm. Are you going to tell us the story about neurons? No, because the building blocks were about the same. And we'll get into stem cells and brain regeneration later. But deeper at the electrochemical level, for some reason, schizophrenia and severe mental health issues, severe depression and just schizophrenia, madness, tends to spike in the 20s. We don't know why, but that there's something going on at the electrochemical level in these giant frontal lobes behind our forehead that leads to the time in which psychiatric diagnosis, severe ones, are made. When we were in medical school, this was taught to us, is in late teens and early 20s. That also coincides with a spike in suicide rates. Also, some would argue a spike in creative abilities. Einstein with 27, many others. We're at 27. So there's a story there, but there's also a potential explanation. I might be completely wrong, but the explanation makes it so I'm not just making stuff up and riffing. Yeah. So the headbanging is an interesting question.
It's not a rock and roll fairy tale, is what you're saying.
Yeah.
That they all just happen to expire for whatever reason at 27.
There is quite a bit of, there's a spike in psychiatric issues in early 20s. Mm-hmm. We are taught... Somebody starts dressing differently, doesn't find their way home, 22-year-old male, little bullets like that, so consider schizophrenia. It's that well known. I'm not talking about something I figured out yesterday. Mm. I mean, it's in medical books for half a century. Mm-hmm. So the headbanging is an interesting thing. We are surprisingly resilient with an occasional bop. Each of my kids have fallen out of the bed. my wife and I argue which side which side was it, when they were with me or with you? Or, and I worked at children's hospitals for a long time, and I still do children's brain surgery around the world. That's my passion, legacy maybe. And people are surprisingly resilient with a knock, single knock. Mm-hmm. But if you, despite wearing a helmet, just every day decide you're going to hit the wall with your head 50 times a day for 10 years, as is in American football, it should be no surprise that those jellyfish and that delicate white flesh is going to be injured. Mm. But we misled people, we meaning sports, science, whatever, the whole thing, that American football actually used to celebrate a hard hit to the head. Mm. And now they've outlawed that. And people say, well, I mean, what is this? It's CTE. Well, I just tell them, well, would you let your kids bang their knee, which is quite resilient, against a wall? Yeah, just bang your knee against the wall 50 times a day for the next 10 years. Mm-hmm. You would say, no, it's going to damage the knee. Mm-hmm. So why did we lose track that banging our head, concussions, repeated concussions, mm-hmm. not a car accident, let me put a caveat there. There are some bad accidents that lead to tearing of vessels, and we mm-hmm. take care of them, but occasional fall, occasional bump, we're surprisingly resilient to that. Mm-hmm. But the constant knock, even at a lower intensity, will physically wither the flesh of your brain and will change the electricity. So now we have which layers are you injured by repeated concussions? And that's called, you know, CTE or whatever they're calling it now. But most people who rocked out, they don't have issues with that. It's in sports when they've had repeated concussions over years and years. But just going wild at a concert, that's just good living.
Okay, good. I shall graduate to toe tapping now. And from rock and roll to drugs, which feels like the perfect segue. But actually, more specifically, caffeine, which is, you know, it's not really a rock and roll drug. And I'm not projecting on you here, but I do have a slight problem with caffeine. And should what is the effect of caffeine on the brain?
It's a stimulant. Mm-hmm. It's mildly addictive, and it's not bad for you. Tea. So these are the way to think about drugs is, again, an explanation. What is caffeine? Caffeine is the ingredient from a bean mm-hmm. when it's manipulated. Mm-hmm. Tea is also from a plant. Coca leaves. I was in Bolivia and Peru, my son. We chewed coca leaves. Mm-hmm. They say coca is not cocaine. It doesn't get you high, but it does let you breathe easier and climb the mountain a little easier. Opium mm-hmm. is from a plant. It alleviates pain mm-hmm. and suffering for people, some of my patients who are in hospice and at the end of their life. So these chemicals are coming from plants. Mm. And so is green juice and other things that we equate with health. These chemicals are actually, in their native forms like that, not very addictive and not very damaging to mm-hmm. the body. When you turn them into, you know, heroin mm-hmm. or you turn into cocaine or you synthesize crystal methamphetamine, which was an epidemic, or crack, then they're extremely dangerous. Mm. So caffeine, there are no studies that show that that is bad for us, and some that show that it can help reduce the incidence of prostate cancer and that sort of thing. The only time I've heard of people getting in trouble with caffeine is if they quickly stop, they get some headaches. Mm-hmm. There's an explanation for that. Or some people have heart arrhythmias, and if they drink too many Red Bulls or caffeines, like 8 or 9, their arrhythmias can be accentuated. Mm-hmm. So outside of, which is a very rare thing. But why does caffeine withdrawal cause headache? So that's an interesting thing right there. So caffeine not only gets your heart rate up a little bit, it is a stimulant. So at the electrochemical level, a few more chemicals or neurotransmitters are released. Mm-hmm. But it also shrinks the blood vessels in the brain. So some people think migraines are from slightly loosened arteries in the brain that lead to throbbing. So some of the treatments for migraines and headaches is actually caffeine. Mm-hmm. So my son, or a patient, and people I've known that have had headaches, I said, so they take Advil or they take ibuprofen or acetaminophen, which is Tylenol, And they also take a shot, an espresso shot. The combination of caffeine plus a pain reliever is an effective treatment, more effective than without the caffeine. Mm-hmm. So caffeine shrinks blood vessels. Caffeine is a stimulant. And it can be addictive, but it has never destroyed lives. People will not steal or injure themselves for it. So it's not addictive in that way. That's my riff on caffeine.
You haven't seen me near a nice near a
triple
nice
espresso. Or maybe you're worse when you don't have it, right? When you're waiting for the caffeine is when you're...
I had a DNA test, and I am 100% that bitch who can metabolize it really well. So I don't seem to have a problem with caffeine. But
that's also in that song by Lizzo. So mm-hmm. that's good. And I like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, I'm really pleased with what I just did there. but can we just talk about what migraines are actually? Mm-hmm. Because I suffer with migraines infrequently, but when I do, my favorite drug is one that combines caffeine, mm-hmm. which I guess allows it to sort of synthesize and absorb and treat quicker. I don't know if that's
the right. Shrinks the blood vessels.
Yes, but if someone's listening to this and they think, I suffer with migraines and every now and again, like, what makes me worry about if my brain is healthy, mm-hmm. what would your response be to that?
The migraines have not been associated with any brain injury at the flesh level, at the cellular level. Mm-hmm. Clearly, there's a headache, so something's going on at the electrochemical level because you feel pain, mm-hmm. Not associated with any cancers, not associated with any strokes. They don't damage you or set you on a path to damage later. Mm-hmm. They can just be incredibly disruptive when you feel them. Mm-hmm. And the pain is not actually surprisingly in your brain, even though it feels like it's in the center of your brain. It's on that lining. I was telling you, that has nerves. Strangely enough, during awake brain surgery, and we clearly the surgeon's awake, but the patient's awake as well. The joke there is the anesthesiologists aren't always awake in surgery. That's an inside joke that maybe I shouldn't be telling, but everybody knows it. So the joke is the anesthesiologist is asleep and the patient's half asleep, because once they get people under, they can kind of check out and go on their email.
Because that's the thing. I've read you talk about some of your surgeries, and they are knocked out while the skull is opened, and then they are woken up so that you can communicate with them. Mm-hmm. Particularly the case with the bilingual teacher was extraordinary.
And well established. Forgive me. I don't want people to think that I am just bringing you knowledge that has been around for 50 years. Awake brain surgery was the way they figured out that this little undulating strip is the thing that controls the opposite arm. It was done like over 50 years ago. But nobody, and the language, all the story you're talking about, It's well known in our world. It just hasn't been explained and shared. But back to the migraines. When the person is awake, you can touch the brain and they don't know their brain is being touched. So the brain actually does not feel pain when you touch it. Mm-hmm. The brain can only sense through through its tentacles that it sends out to your face, called cranial nerves, or the nerves on top of that sheath, or the nerves right here on the side where your glasses sit, those muscles, the temporalis muscles, or the tension headaches in the back of your head, where those muscles come up from your spine to grab the back of your skull. These are the locations and origin of pain. It's not actually, it feels like it's in the middle of your skull, but it's not. It's the outside of your skull sending messages to your mind and brain saying, I'm feeling pain. So migraines are a problem of nerves on the covering of the brain, on the skull, on the muscles, and the scalp, and that sort of thing, as well as light can be bothersome. So they're, again, because the eyes are extensions of the brain that send information inward. So what I would say about migraines is there's no long-term sequelae or damaging effects, but in the short term, they can be so disruptive. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, people, when they don't go to work or they don't go to school because they have terrible migraines, the people on the other side that have not had migraines...
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
If you're dismissive about it. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yet I know people who are in a dark room for 2 days agonizing. Mm. So I just think we have to be more respectful of people's struggles that aren't immediately graspable by everyone. Mm-hmm. And pain is one of those components, mm-hmm. not just migraines, but mind pain, that people who are depressed, people who have anxiety, that mental health is the same as physical health, and I would say is actually more important than physical health, because people who don't have mental health, they will never take care of their bodies. So if you're trying to motivate somebody to be more active or lose weight or keep their heart arteries open by exercising, that's hard to do if your mind isn't in the right place, right? Because it takes ambition and willpower. So I think everything begins with mental health, for changing not only yourself, but then also changing habits that will lead to a longer life and a better life.
Well, to that end, talking about mental health, I was curious, and because of the way you've described the brain, I don't know whether this will be the case, but if someone is a smoker, mm-hmm. and you look at their lungs, you're, without knowing or speaking to them, you might say, they've been on 20 a day for however long. Mm. If somebody is experiencing, could you crack open a skull?
Great question.
And tell if somebody has depression or anxiety or any kind of mental illness?
No. So that's, first of all, thank you. Oh. One, for the question, and two, for letting me explain a little bit about the ways in which we should think about our brains and mind. Again, back to the flesh, the anatomy is no different. Mm. Okay. So you open up thousands of skulls. I've opened up thousands of skulls. The ones who have on their chart say they have depression, it doesn't look any different. It doesn't look any different to the naked eye. Mm. Then at the cellular level, the building block level, the grain of sand that is the thing that makes the sand sculpture, right? The cells, neurons. You turn up the microscope and it doesn't look any different. Where mental health exists is in that immense complexity of electricity and chemistry, mm-hmm. that those, again, 90 billion microscopic jellyfish with 10,000 or more tentacles, all tangled and aligned, spraying neurotransmitters at each other, mm-hmm. and spraying electricity. And you say, okay, how do you know it's at that level? Well, I can prove it. That's why on a strange, not strange, but strange cases of lightning bolts and savants. Those are extreme examples. But more importantly, shock therapy to treat depression is basically zapping with electricity those 90 billion jellyfish. And people wake up after a few treatments without severe depression. I'm not saying that's for you or that you should do that, or your opinions. I'm trying to establish a concept, mm-hmm. that the mind is off or disrupted at the electrical level, mm-hmm. okay? Then somebody else with depression goes and takes some pills. Takes a few weeks to kick in. Antidepressants. What are antidepressants doing? Are they building the flesh? No. Are they building the building blocks? No. Are they messing with the electricity? Yes, but not directly. What they're doing is they're leaving more serotonin in between those almost near touches. Mm-hmm. So depression is an electrical and chemical imbalance, mm-hmm. and that's why it can be treated by electrical and chemical manipulation, mm-hmm. such as shock therapy or antidepressant medicines.
Mm-hmm. But it's not visible to the naked eye.
Not at all.
One thing that sometimes goes hand in hand with these mental health issues is sleep. Mm. And you seem like a brilliant person to speak to about sleep, partly because I think we're all so disrupted. We no longer get up with the sun and go to bed with the moon.
Very
because we have
excellent
artificial light.
Yeah, I know. That's really where it's at. I put in a lot of sleepless days. Surgical training in the United States in the 90s. we routinely worked 120 hours a week. So that means go in for Monday morning at 4 a.m., come home Tuesday at 7 p.m., go in Wednesday at 4 a.m., come back Wednesday night at 7 or 8, go in Thursday at 4 a.m., mm-hmm. come back Friday at 7 p.m. That's a five-day work week. And so I like to say that, I like to tell people that, not because I'm the only one that endured it. My colleagues were doing it. Other people were doing it. So mm-hmm. I'm not saying that in a way to make people say, oh, he's got willpower. No, that was just the training. So we have a large group of people beyond sleep deprived. We can talk to truckers back then in the States. And what were the lessons there? Well, we know that graveyard shifts and disrupted sleep, and you have more issues with heart disease. And what's the connect there? It's a metabolic thing that we are in tune with the Earth's rotation as our animals and plants. And it's not melatonin, the single hormone for sleep. I mean, are we really that? Now that you've seen the complexity explained from my point of view, can one pill really address all of those structural, neuronal, electrochemical things? No. There's in between our eyes where they converge. Nobel Prize was given for this just a few years ago. Small cluster of primitive ancient cells that are just there to let us know when the rotation is day and night. And from there, they change things in our brain at the electrochemical level, at the genetic level. Mm-hmm. Genes turning on and off daily and nightly. Not just in our brain, in our body. Mm-hmm. That's what leads to heart disease and other issues. Because how do you connect sleep deprivation with heart disease? Mm-hmm. Because the heart is also under the dominion of the brain. And the brain is saying, it's nighttime, daytime, nighttime, sunrise, sunset. And so we learned a few things. Interrupted sleep was worse than shorter sleep. Mm-hmm. So on the night, if there was a chance to sleep for just an hour and a half, let's say it's like 2:30 to 3:30.
Skip it.
You're going to be more foggy the next day. I don't know the biological basis of that, but I can bring you 20 surgeons that will tell you the same thing. Mm-hmm. So that was like a cult insider thing, like don't even bother because you got work to do the next day. Mm-hmm. But that translates to my kids. Like, can you please just leave the phone, on airplane mode? Or the younger ones, can you just put outside? Mm-hmm. The minute you get up and you leave your room, grab it, check it in the car. But can you not have it on your nightstand? Because that interrupted sleep won't let you get into those deeper sleep cycles. That's not rest. That is the housekeeping the brain does while it sleeps. The electricity is on fire when you're sleeping. It's not coma. It's just doing something else. The subconscious is having its time. All the stimulation from the day before is being processed. Should I really be holding on to the billions of things my eyes have seen, the smells I've had?
Because you take in everything. The brain,
of course,
sees everything.
And sleep says which things should be held on to. Otherwise, you'd be too jam-packed. So sleep is an active process. Mm. So when you're tired the next day, it's not that you didn't get rest. It's that you didn't really clear out the gunk from the day before. So that's the concept behind sleep. Interrupted sleep, to me, is worse than shorter sleep. And if you struggle falling asleep, it's because your brain's not ready to have that laptop. Listen, if you can have a triple espresso, have your laptop on bright, binge, shut it down, fall asleep, good for you. Mm. But I'm talking about people who struggle to sleep well. The brain needs a few hours of dampened light to initiate the transition into sleep.
And what about things like binaural beats? Because if I can't sleep, that's what I put on. I put on my, is it theta waves?
Whatever works for you. So there's white noise, there's music. So your devices can become your allies. Mm. The first thing I do is I just have dimmers all around the house. My kids are always like, Dad, it is so dark. It's only 8 o'clock. And it's not dark. It's just I'm bringing it down to ambient because I'm trying to tell myself. I think it looks cooler, too. The furniture and the styling is better, too, with a little dimmer light. But they are, that is the thing where they're always like, it's 8 o'clock, Dad. Why are you turning down the lights? Not off, but I just start hitting the dimmers. And you can even preset them if you have the interest or the luxury to do that.
Yeah.
Yeah, again. So the phone, the device can be your ally. Mm. And some people are even looking at patterns of posting on social media to detect people who are suicidal or thinking negative thoughts in their way they tweet and the way they text and the way they respond and the things they search. I don't want anybody knowing what I'm doing on my phone. I think that's an invasion of privacy, but it has that potential if people want to use it for creative purposes and for helping each other purposes. And so the device is not an automatic enemy. It just needs to be handled.
Well, you know, Netflix contacted somebody who watched The Christmas Prince 18 times in a row and said, "Are you okay?"
I didn't know that.
Which I think is amazing. I was worried they were going to get in touch.
And once they found out if they were okay, they were like, "And what made you watch? Because if we could figure that out, then we can have other people binge watch."
But if someone's listening to this and they think, actually, I am really guilty, as I am, of waking up usually between 2 and 3 in the morning and checking my phone because I am addicted to it.
Mm-hmm.
Should, as a brain surgeon,
it's not hurting you.
Okay.
And if you're doing, if you're crushing it the next day, you're doing well. Or, you know, there's somebody you're wanting to hear from, an opportunity you're waiting for, then it's exciting and it wakes you up. That's fine. If it's a general habit and you can pull it off, that's fine, too. These aren't hard and fast rules. These are for people who struggle to sleep. Some people get up in the middle of the night and go to the bathroom every night. They fall back asleep and they're fine. Fine. I'm not here to tell people what to do. I'm here just to explain how it works.
Mm-hmm.
So if you are struggling with that, then there in the explanation you can find real strategies and maneuvers, a toolkit to improving yourself.
Now, I also want to talk about, we're in the city of London. I'm looking out the window.
I'm in love with London.
I know. I can see a black cab, which brings me nicely on to sat-nav. But also, you know that London cabbies do this thing called the knowledge. And so
amazing.
A part of their brain is under MRI scanning, apparently. You're the brain surgeon, not me. Larger.
And there, they have grown flesh a little bit. So now now the explanation isn't at that level.
Mm-hmm. Would you be able to see that if you crack the skull or only on MRI?
Well, that's an interesting question. So you can measure it on MRI, but brain volume doesn't always equate with brain function.
Okay.
We have to keep that in mind because you could have a perfect-looking brain, but at the electrochemical level, you could be disrupted.
Okay.
But when we crack the skull open... that feels coarse, but when it's more ice fishing, it's a delicate creating of a small opening the size of a cookie. You want to find the smallest window to getting to where you want to get.
Mm-hmm.
So we would rarely crack that much open. So
sorry,
it wouldn't be,
It's like I'm shocking an oyster. I apologize.
Yeah. Well, the contents might look similar, at least in color. But no, it's not something I could detect.
Okay.
And it's very subtle, but it speaks to something. It also speaks to the fact that when patients get dementia, Alzheimer's being the most common type, it tends to happen as we get older, as we get less young. And many of us, many of our parents are aging, surviving as heart disease has been not eradicated, but handled quite well.
Mm-hmm.
And so you have a lot of 70-year-olds, 80-year-olds, and 90-year-olds. And the brain never was challenged to make it that far because either people were eaten by lions in their 20s and 30s or working conditions were so difficult and lifespan was 40s and 50s. And then when heart disease was there, it was 70, 65, 68, 74. But now as we continue to tackle those diseases and we're getting to 70s, 80s, 90s, you are going to see degeneration of the brain at all of those levels, flesh, neuron, and electrochemistry. So dementia is actually a problem of all of those things. In that area, the temporal lobes, so now anatomically it's by where the stem of your glasses would be.
Mm-hmm.
If you went in 2 centimeters, there's a lobe there. And it's got something called the hippocampus. It's shaped like a seahorse. Emotion and memory tend to be there. So as that withers at the flesh level, at the cellular level, and gets, you know, glitches out at the electrochemical level, That's Alzheimer's. There will be no simple fix for that.
Mm.
The pills in the big pharma industry in America are failing miserably. And because of the complexity, it's not just opening an artery, right? That you could tackle scientifically. And so what we find is people who have put more into that cognitive piggy bank in all of those dimensions, they tend to do better when they get in their 70s and 80s. So the knowledge, the knowledge is a building of memory, is education, is a life actively lived. The cognitive piggy bank is sort of, you have built up the cells and the tissue and the electrochemistry there in the memory area. And so those people, even when they do get Alzheimer's, they are still more capable with the disease.
I read, and it wasn't a paper, but I read that because we are so addicted to our phones and we take pictures of everything, that the brain's ability to make memories in the way that it maybe did 30 years ago is diminishing. Is that something that you would back up?
Well, I don't know. I haven't read about it. I haven't thought about it. But interestingly, on the other way, is the more we outsource to the phone, that part of the brain we rely less on. And so what I do with my kids is say, we try not to use the route map. I want to see them develop their sense of spatial navigation. Mm. That's also in the same area. That's why patients with Alzheimer's get lost. Mm. Memory, spatial navigation, and emotion is there. So does that mean we are setting ourselves up for some demise? No, I think we are still memorizing and learning many other things. I don't want to memorize phone numbers. I'm so thankful to not have to do that and all the other things. So the phone is my ally.
But be honest, do you know your phone number from the house that you lived in when you were a kid?
Yeah, that one stuck with me.
Yeah, exactly.
And interestingly, when patients do get injury, it's only those old, deeply entrenched memories they have onto. So sometimes there was a famous patient who struggled after a surgery. He kept going back to the original house. I mean, he could find his way home, but it was the original home.
Interesting.
Yeah, yeah. So that's that. I do remember that phone number, but it's also because I used it a lot. Now I just look at a picture and a name, and I press click. I don't even see the actual number being called. It just says wife or son, mom.
Now, I know that we're drawing rapidly towards the end of our time together, so there are a couple of things I wanted to get from you.
So let's do rapid fire.
Let's do rapid fire. Well, it's basically, my most excellent listeners, if you could give them any advice, whether it's three top tips or something about how to look after their brain health or just live a, I think if you look after your brain, you probably are going to live a better life.
We are our brains, yeah.
Yeah. What would your advice be?
So I'll do rapid fire five things, and all of them are easy to do and high yield. I'm not trying to add work to anybody's life. Please don't add work to mine. I want to choose the work I want to do. One would be consider skipping breakfast. The brain is a hybrid vehicle. When you don't eat for 16 hours, with much respect to the world who struggles to find food and food hunger and quality food, that said, if you skip eating water, coffee is fine, for 16 hours, you run out of glucose. You're a coffee addict, so I had to throw that in there.
Yeah,
but you run out of glucose and then you don't die. Oh, your liver turns fat into ketones. So the brain's a hybrid vehicle. For mental clarity, it's been shown that switching between glucose and ketones as a fuel for your brain is one way to do it. So it's not about what you eat. It's about the cadence of eating. So going without breakfast, having a meal at 2 o'clock and having the dinner before, that'll get you to 16, 17 hours easy. So try that a couple of times a week. And if you want to lose weight, just eat a lot less. This is not about weight loss. So that's my tip about the brain's a hybrid vehicle and why periods of food scarcity and 16, 17 hour stretches a couple of times a week would help. However that fits in, skipping breakfast is the easiest way. So that's what I do. Number two is deep breathing. It is your built-in Valium. I don't know what mindfulness is. I don't know what's going on in your mind or their mind. Our interior lives are private and sometimes even a mystery to ourselves. But deep breathing is a way to have the nerves that descend from the brain work in a dual direction. They are bilateral. They are two-lane roads. And so it's been shown, and in my book, there's actually a surgical study where they measured real electricity, not just people's opinions. So deep breathing with 3 seconds in, hold for 3 seconds and 3 seconds out. That is a resource to you. That is your built-in volume. Is that as effective? Is that no? But this is the toolkit with which you can try to tackle self-improvement. And it's free. It's not, there's nothing to sell. These are things that are available to ourselves. The other thing I would say is change the food you eat. I'm not trying to punish anybody, but there is no treatment for dementia. But there is the prevention of dementia is well established. Decades of studies, thousands of people across countries. And it's called the MIND diet, which is really a parallel to the cardiac diet. It's a Mediterranean diet. So if when you do choose to eat, so there's the cadence of eating, and then there's what you are ingesting. It's occasional. It's not the indulgence, a burger, a cake. You go in somebody's house for a party. This is not a time. I mean, you know, that's not the time to be so strict that you're disrupting your social interaction. I don't believe in that. Mm-hmm. But it's in the daily routines, what you put in should be mostly plants, mm-hmm. beans, occasional fatty fish, some red wine. That doesn't sound like a difficult diet. And that diet, flavonoids are these little things in the plants, the antioxidants. Fatty fish has omega-3s that actually wrap the tentacles in your brain. So there's an explanation to each one of those. Mm. Red wine is actually, you know, juice from a plant. And so that kind of living, coffee, is that kind of living is right in front of us and proven. Mm. And we don't have to believe in a cult or a guru or somebody with a microphone standing in front of you saying this or that. Yoga and meditation is free. It's available to everyone. The elitism with the self-help industry bothers me. Mm-hmm. And actually, they exploit the complexity of the brain, our lack of understanding of the brain, and I would say, and they cannot explain why their self-help tips really work, to sell things to us.
Yeah, because new clothes.
Yeah. It's the ultimate scam. We are being lied to about ourselves, our brains and minds. The cadence of eating, what you're eating, deep breathing, meditated deep breathing. There are apps for that, how you set that cadence, so that works. And all these things have proof. Exercising a little bit. So what I would say is I live in the land of Brad Pitt and Bradley Cooper, which is fantastic, but that's...
I'm going to need to
address. I want to do a live interview. I don't know them, but they're there. But those beach bodies is not really what you need to get to, because that is an obstacle for people who think, how will I get there? I'm just starting... The brain responds from doing just a little bit more. Mm-hmm. And the biggest yield is not sitting, but standing and walking. Mm-hmm. So if you can walk briskly for a half hour, a couple of times a week, you're getting 80% of the result for that. And the last tip I would say, the fifth thing is enjoy yourself if you can. Think a little bit. It's thinking flesh. Mm-hmm. If we wanted bigger biceps, we know what to do. If we want a healthier brain, it is built and designed to think. And so thinking, learning, reading, taking a different route home, challenging yourself a little bit, trying to learn a new language, you don't have to get good at it. Just trying to do new things as a habit a couple of times a week. Not all day, because we have work to do. I think these are the simple things that are there that you could change without spending money. Mm. And, you might feel better about yourself and your life.
I do have a final question.
Okay.
I think it might be a toughie, though. It is this, given your proximity that you've had to the brain, and I know that you are a fan of the deep breathing and of meditation, and I have spoken to people who have meditated and say that they have had out-of-body experiences and they have felt that their consciousness is not just within them, it is without them. Do you think there's life after death?
I like Keanu Reeves' answer when somebody asked him that. He said, in the hearts and the memories of your loved ones. That's where life is after death. I don't have any idea about those sort of concepts. Mm. But having an outer body experience is not the same as life after death. Mm-hmm. We have dissociative states. We have split personalities. You can take ketamine in a club and float above yourself. And during those awake brain surgeries, sometimes when we tickle that temporal lobe, patients will report, I saw myself floating above the operating room. I think out-of-body experiences, dissolution of ego, those sort of concepts are different than Does something continue on after after all those 90 billion brain cells die? I would say life after death is up to your own. That's a freedom of thought that is for the individual. Because sometimes it helps my cancer patients. And my original book I wanted to write was No Atheists in the Cancer Center. They might be atheists before or after, but when you come to that crisis that you have grown a cancer within you, you weren't infected by it, you grew it. They have this thing called existential crisis. And in New York, some centers are looking at using psychedelics to deal with the anxiety, the existential crisis of having a cancer. So I'm deep in those fields, and life after death is, I think, for you to decide for yourself. And depending on where you're at in your life, it might be a valuable concept for you. In that way, it's real.
If we had another hour, we would be talking about the neural pathways, the psilocybin, mushrooms, everything. We would be doing all sorts. But I know that we don't have that time. But thank you so much for joining me on the show.
The pleasure's mine. I'm always happy to be included. I never take it for granted.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening. I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Dr. Rahul Jandial. I know I did. I think I enjoyed the fact that he doesn't speak in absolutes. It's so tempting when you sit in front of an expert, whoever they are, whatever their field is, to want them almost to tell you the black and white, to say, do this, don't do that, and then everything will be okay. And it's so pleasing to sit in front of an expert who really embraces the fact that it's a little bit of this, it's a little bit of that, it's a bit more fluid and it's not as rigid. That's something that as I was walking home after this conversation, I thought, actually, I did want him to say some absolutes, but I was really pleased in a way that he didn't. Anyway, let me know what you think. Email me on thebeautypodcast@gmail.com. Join the Facebook group. The link to join is in the show notes. Start a conversation about this particular episode, whether there's anything that stood out particularly. Or you can always DM me on social media, where I'm at Emma Guns on Twitter and Instagram. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. And I will always get back to you if you do message me. Thank you so much for listening. I will see you on the next one.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.